Okay, guys, welcome back. If you've got your Bible with you, perhaps you turn with me to the second book of Samuel. We are going through this series of messages about David, the king of hearts. And last week we began by looking at the need for patience in our lives, especially at times when we think we've run out of patience. And this week I want to look chapter 2, verse 12, right up until chapter 5, verse 3. So it's a long reading if we were going to read it all, but we're not going to read it all. It's way too long, and I wouldn't have any time left to preach, and that would be terrible. So I'm going to only read to you just the first three verses, actually, of chapter 5 as a kind of summary of where it gets to in a moment. But let me give you some background, especially if you're new here. We are talking about a remarkable person. David was a great king in Israel's history and one of the kind of great heroes of the Bible. One of the great heroes of history, really. But he, from a very young age, knew that he would be king. It was a promise that was given him by God. And yet, as soon as he kind of got the promise, he was kind of screwed from that point on because his life was just difficult, constantly difficult. Every single situation he got into seemed to be a difficulty which was designed, custom designed, to cause him to struggle, cause him to need to trust God and rely on God some more. And so, of course, that is exactly what David learned to do over the years. And it got to the final point where it looked like it would finally get set right. The problem he primarily had was that the previous king, Saul, had been his opponent, his enemy. He'd persecuted him. He chased him down. And it looked as though finally everything was going to come right because Saul was dead. Saul had died in battle, and it looked like the coast is finally clear. I can enter into my destiny, my dream, the thing that I'd hoped for forever has finally come true. I guess you all know situations like that to some extent, where the thing you waited for is finally in your lap. It's like, I have this opportunity to enter into my destiny, my dream. And for David, it looked so good, and then suddenly, it's at the last moment interfered with because Saul's son, Ishbosheth, who's not a great leader, he's a kind of ordinary person, he gets put forward as an alternative king to David, up in the northern tribes, and actually a much bigger part of the country. David starts ruling from Hebron in the bottom of the country. Only a small kind of chunk of the nation is turning to him. The majority are still with Saul's family out of a sense of loyalty to Saul, who was this great king of the previous generation. So David is wrestling in this in-between stage now, having to exert a lot of patience to handle the delay. And yet what we find at the end of the three chapters that I'm not going to read to you, this extraordinary summary point where it gets to chapter 5, verse 1, then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel." This is going to have to start with me summarizing how we got there. Okay, we got from this place where it looked like everything he dreamed of was being taken away from him in the last moment all over again, to this place where the whole nation comes out and says, "We're yours, we're with you, heart and soul. We get it, we're on your side, we're finally coming under your authority. You are the king, David," and this dream he had from his youth is fulfilled. Chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. How do we get there? Well, the route through to this is basically a civil war, and it's kind of violent, it's kind of slow, it's kind of interesting. It reads a little bit more like Game of Thrones than what you might expect when you open your Bible. It's got a lot of strange moments in it, and it's kind of Well, it actually starts with a moment that's a little bit more like Hunger Games, because you get this strange situation where Joab, who's David's commander-in-chief, David's kind of hatchet man, and Abner, who is the guy who put Ishbosheth on the throne, Abner is Saul's commander-in-chief. Saul's dead, and so Abner's trying to use Ishbosheth to get power in the north. And Joab is on David's side, or thinks he is, trying to get power for David and his group in the south. And they get together, and they basically have this kind of Hunger Games scenario where you've got basically 12 warriors from each side paired off against each other to see who will win. And it's a kind of gross gladiatorial kind of sport. In this situation, all 24 die. So no winners on this occasion, it seems. They all basically run each other through, and it kind of results in no helpful outcome. It just leads to more fighting. And in the fighting that ensues, Joab has a brother called Asahel who starts chasing Abner, the commander of Saul's armies. And they get into this long chase, and Asahel's fast, and Abner's a little older, and it looks as though Asahel's got him. But it's one of those situations where kind of he gets tricked. Asahel is basically running kind of too fast, effectively. It's like a cartoon, except that Abner's not running around the corner with a frying pan. He's just got his spear ready, and he holds his spear out behind his back, and Asahel basically runs into it, and it says it goes through his belly and out the other side. Now, you're thinking, now you read to us a few weeks ago a list of names, and you're not reading this bit. This is the best bit in the Bible we've come across for weeks. But I remember when my dad read us this story when I was a kid at breakfast time, I remember saying, which page is that on? Tell me more about this stuff, because these are the stories that kind of can grip your imagination as a kid, I suppose. And it kind of goes on with these story after story of vicious kind of conflicts, and it gets ugly, and it's like the writer is trying to make a point. Look how wretched the situation got before it got better. So it's not giving us the results, it's giving us match of the day. It's going in for the highlights. It's showing us some actual moments of conflict and battle. And on that day, Abner's army does badly. And from that point on, as it says in chapter 3, verse 1, it says there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Meanwhile, Abner gets into a massive fight with Ishbosheth. Now remember, Ishbosheth is the kind of puppet king. He's this fairly ineffectual guy who Abner has set up as the possible ruler instead of David. And so Abner so far has been touting him as the best guy to run the country, but he gets into a major conflict over a mistress. So I told you it was a charming story. There's basically one of Saul's ex-concubines. Ishbosheth accuses Abner of sleeping with Saul's concubine. And Abner doesn't like being accused of this. He gets angry. He kind of seems to use it as an excuse to switch sides. And you think, well, maybe he saw which way the wind was blowing. He joins David. He goes to David and says, I'm going to try and help you to now become king of the whole nation. And he starts talks with David, and it looks actually as though this might work. It looks as though Abner's betrayal could be the thing that God uses to put David properly on the throne, because there's this kind of togetherness now, and Abner's bringing a lot of people with him. It's like a big summit talk, and there's progress, and there's a chance now for peace. It looks good. It looks like Abner is the key to peace. Even though he's kind of a wretched man, he's helping in this instance. And David is beginning to hope. And then Joab shows up. Joab's been away while the talks have been going on. He hears about this important summit that's been happening, and he speaks angrily to David about letting Abner into his house. And then he basically takes Abner aside, tricks him into thinking he wants to have a secret talk with him, and stabs him to death. But up to this point, Joab has been harboring a massive grudge against him for killing his brother with the spear incident. But also, you've got to realize Joab is massively motivated by his rivalry against Abner. If Abner pulls this off and brings the nation together for David, Joab is obviously feeling very concerned that this could be bad for him. The commander that I am, I suddenly become irrelevant. And so where do I fit? So there's this massive rivalry, there's this jealousy that seems to be going on as well. And the whole peace prospect is set back once again. So you can see I'm taking a long time over this story because I want you to see how kind of miserable it gets. And it gets worse and worse because while Abner had joined Joab, it looked already as though Ishbosheth, the false king, his position was getting a little bit precarious. But now he's dead, I guess it's even more precarious. So David's power base is getting a little bit stronger down in the south. And Ishbosheth, he's looking very vulnerable. He hasn't got a great commander next to him called Abner helping him to run things. He's just on his own. And you think, what's going to happen? How's it all going to work out? And then it all ends when a couple of raiders, some Benjamites, who are not particularly impressive people, Rahib and Barney, they turn up in Ishbosheth's palace, and effectively, I mean, they're basically bodyguards who ought to be looking after him. They turn on him, kill him in a vicious, horrible way, and bring his head to David. They have to travel a couple of days to do it across Israel, which is not a place to walk with a head in your bag. And they get to David's court in Hebron, they offer up his head, and they are fully expecting David to say to them, fantastic, thank you, boys, well done, now our troubles are over, I'm so pleased you did the dirty on this guy, we needed it done, and now we're secure and we can get moving. David, if you know him, is not going to do that. He's not that kind of guy. He's infuriated by this evil, wicked thing that they've done to the king. And he actually has both of them put to death immediately. He has them executed, and he actually has some of their body parts put on display. Okay, so I'm just giving you the whole thing. I'm just letting you know what's going on, all right? Just be honest. It's in the book. Let's not pretend it's not there. These are stories that, let's be honest, they're amazing, but they're also a little bit gross, and we just need to admit that they're there. Now, that's where it basically gets to the point where the whole nation, okay, everybody can see what David's like more and more. They see the qualities in, they see what he's not like, and they see what he is like. And by the time it gets to chapter 5, you can see they're kind of ready to turn to him. So there's the long, long story. There's the background I wanted to give you as a way of kind of summarizing how it got to be that David was finally on the throne. But the route that he used to get there was, like I said, it was characterized by a lot of conflict, a lot of infighting. And it's like the writer wants you to see just how monstrous people can become in situations where there's jealousy and where there is selfish ambition. Because that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with thugs, knaves, people who are characterized by opportunism, violence, anger, retaliation, selfishness, lust, and aggressive pursuit of their own personal interests at the expense of anybody else's. And it just keeps coming, this kind of constant kind of story of fighting, murder, violence, attack. It keeps going back and forth, back and forth. And violence begets violence, as we see in life all the time. We see in the newspapers, we see in the Middle East situation. Retaliation often is the way that the kind of story seems to be unraveling itself again and again and again. And I suppose if we're not careful, we can miss the more immediate application because of the violence. It's such a violent story. It seems kind of, most of us, you know, between now and next Sunday, we're not going to be dealing in Brighton and Hove with situations quite like this, with decapitations and you know, people's hands being cut off and put on display. And it's not characteristic of doing your shopping in George Street particularly. But the Bible is much subtler than that. And one of the reasons these stories are here is because they actually do apply to us on a heart level. See, Jesus, when he came teaching, he says it in Matthew chapter 5, if you are angry towards your brother, if you hate him in your heart, if you call him a fool, then you're guilty of murder. In the same way that someone who looks at someone lustfully is is guilty of adultery. Jesus talks about wickedness as something that may or may not get expressed in an action of the hands, but it's already crossed a line in the heart. Something has happened internally that God sees and God equates with the actual expression of that sin. He's not saying it's exactly the same thing, but he's saying the seed of it is actually there in the heart already. And the way in which we operate and act in our ordinary relationships, in the way that we do community, the way that we do marriage, the way that we do family, the way that we do the workplace, the way that we do business, the way that we do church, is going to be characterized by all kinds of passions and desires and ambitions and jealousies being expressed. Now, they won't get expressed frequently. We haven't had many murders in CCK. But you see, there's a reason why that is, and that is that we're not living quite in this situation. Now and again through history, and we mustn't be naive, there are times when it comes much closer to our door than we might realize, the lid kind of comes off, or the stabilizers in society kind of come off. And what people are really capable of gets expressed. Let's not fool ourselves. The reason why we don't live with quite this level of violence isn't because we're nicer people than them. It really isn't. It's because when a nation is going through a season of conflict and civil war, and we know about this, you just read about the last few years in various countries, people who are just like us descending into spirals of violence that you think, how could that happen? But of course, when society begins to come off the tracks and loses its stability, it gives way to what's in the heart. God is very gracious and kind in letting us live in a society that's relatively stable, where there's way less expectation of danger and violence than there would have been in some other cultures in history and some other cultures in the world right now. And that's kind of him. That helps us. But it doesn't mean that we're not characterized by jealousies, that we're not characterized by selfish ambition. I mean, the New Testament puts it really clear when James, Jesus' older brother, writes in chapter 3 of his letter, which is just parked outside Hebrews, where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. It's interesting that he even says in the same kind of chunk of scripture, you get down to chapter 4, verse 1, which I don't think will come on the screen. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. Does James literally mean that there's been murders in that church he's writing to? No, he's not saying that. He's definitely not saying that. He's kind of saying, look, this is the characteristic of this expression of the heart. When the lid comes off, when it's allowed its full reign, when God doesn't protect us from ourselves, this is where our passions can go. If we don't allow jealousies and selfish ambition to be checked in our hearts. And that really is the story of what we've got here. We've got a story in David's career of jealousies and selfish ambitions having full reign in a nation. God's kind enough to give us these stories to say, look, be warned. This is the destruction. This is the pattern of life that you fall into. And though it might not end literally in violence in many of our cases, the violence we do with our words, with our gossip, with our attitudes towards one another, with our insults, with our tricks, or our passive aggression, these things are still destructive and harmful and create a harvest, as James says, a harvest of destruction in lives and in communities. God warns us. God's kind to us. God draws our attention to the danger of it to help us to avoid what can go on. You can even see how religion can get brought in to play a part in this. The bad guys in these stories, they're still religious. They're not beyond using the name of God in the way they conduct these situations. So the guys that bring David's news to him, the guys that bring the head of Ish-bosheth to David. You can get in chapter 4, verse 8, you can see it right there. Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and his offspring. You see what they're doing there? These guys, they don't care about the Lord. They are not interested in God. They're not really that interested in David. They're opportunists. They're on the make. They've taken out Ish-bosheth because it gives them an opportunity to get decent jobs in David's kingdom now that David is definitely going to be king. There's nothing noble or pure or generous about their attitude in this story. But they're very happy to use God language. You know, I guess as a pastor, I'm often aware and stunned by the way in which we can use God language in situations where we're being completely ungodly. And some of the letters or emails that you get, or some of the comments that get thrown around, and we throw in a verse or two, or we say, well, this is, I'm very concerned about the purpose of God in this church. I'm very concerned about bringing even news to me. Joel, I'm just very concerned about this brother sharing some information. I'm thinking, I'm really not sure if what I'm hearing is concern for the brother. What I'm hearing is jealousy. What I'm hearing is selfish ambition. What I'm hearing is a desire to disqualify and cast mud on someone so as to better your own opportunities and your own cause. So I guess, I mean, there's one commentator who puts it like this. They come to David with blood on their hands and theology on their lips. It's a nice pithy phrase, a good way of summarizing the situation. We could be speaking religiously, but sinning willfully in our hearts. This is a massive warning to us. James says, be careful. Look to see the passions that grow, that exist. Look to see the yearnings and the desires that become dominant in your hearts. Because when they do dominate, they bring destruction in their wake, even if they have religious tone in the way in which they're expressed. So here you've got this horrible background, but then just to say as well, in this story, you've got David as an amazing counterpoint. David comes across as the incredibly attractive opposite throughout this story. His way, in many ways, he kind of seems like the kind of perfect foil, the opposite character. He's patiently watching. He's not grabbing. He's not involved in the violence. When people go off to kill, like Joab killing Abner, thinking I'm doing this for my master David, David turns up at Abner's funeral and follows carefully in procession and writes a song in honor of Abner. David is full of praise for Abner, who was his enemy. For years, Abner's been a terrible threat to David, a problem for David. And even in his boyhood, Abner chased David around the desert on behalf of Saul. And yet at Abner's death, David is first there at the funeral, weeping and singing over his body and saying what a great and noble man he was. David's an extraordinary person throughout the story. He's such a counterbalance to the ugliness that you see on display throughout in these situations. And you look at the way he did it, you think, how could he have had such a different attitude? How could he stay and remain so pure? And I guess you kind of see a hint of it in chapter 4, verse 9, when these guys, Rechab and Baana, bring Ish-bosheth's head to David. He says, David answered Rechab and Baana, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, as the Lord lives, who has brought my life out of every adversity. That is laden with meaning. See, David is such a different character. He's such a different person to these others. Why? Because he is so aware of God's faithfulness. He's so aware that if he gets to be the king he's been promised to be, it will be 100% because God gets him there. It will be because of God's faithfulness. He knows God has kept me. He took me out of every adversity. And he's known such adversities. He's known such struggles and problems and trials and difficulties again and again and again. He's seen how hard life can be. each time he's seen a way that God has taken me through it. God has helped me. God has lifted me. God has been faithful. God has never been unfaithful to me. Even at times when I thought he was being unfaithful to me, because it looked like he was, I found out years down the track he wasn't. I found out all the time he'd been planning my escape. He'd been working on my behalf. He'd been working things together for good. He says, as surely as the Lord lives, who has taken me out of every adversity. That's the way I'm going to live. I'm going to build my life on, in confidence on his ability to rescue me and to raise me up and to set things up straight for me. I don't know if that's the way you think, but that's David's heart. And my urge to you today is to learn from him, to learn from his example, to think, how can we have that same confidence, that same ability? See, I mean, it's worth saying, the problem that we see in the story is not because people have used authority. Authority is not actually the problem. See, we live in an age where authority is so easily abused, and so many of us have been burned by bosses, leaders, even parents, people in authority over us. And we live in a culture which tends to level everything anyway, that we're very passionate about our democracy, about our equality. We don't really want the power to be shored up ever in one person. We don't trust the one person. We don't like the possibility that one person could have that power. And so we want to spread, we want to equalize, we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And so we're suspicious of authority. But what we have here is one who carries authority wisely, well, graciously, on behalf of others, humbly, caring more about justice and righteousness than he does about his own ends. So the problem isn't authority. The problem is counterfeit authority. It's good things that get counterfeited, isn't it? No one goes into their basement to, you know, spend hours and hours preparing counterfeits of waste paper. They do counterfeits of things that are valuable. You counterfeit currency that you can use. People will count, there's a counterfeit, there's a pretended kind of authority, a false kind of authority that's on display throughout this story from these other people. A seizing of power, aggression, selfish use of violence. It's not his way. He's kind of meek. He's kind of got power, but he uses it wisely. That's a word we don't often use, the word meek. The actual English word for meek, it's got association with when a horse has been trained properly, when it's been broken, when it's got the bit in its mouth and it's been through a process of being harnessed and prepared and saddled and useful. And meekness is not the absence of strength, in other words. David is incredibly strong. For all kinds of reasons, he's strong. He has got a mighty army by now, some very impressive people, like Joab, for example. He's also got God's promise over his life. He's going to be in battles where he can actually hear angels marching. That happens in this book. The sense of power, the sense of spiritual power, physical power that's at his disposal is immense. And yet he's very, very meek. He's very controlled. He's like a horse that's been broken. A horse brings all of its strength to the battle, but it's useful in the battle. It's not wild. It's not running to and fro and causing havoc. It's serving the master. It's serving the rider. David, by this point, has become far meeker, perhaps, than he was as a younger man, and definitely meeker than Joab and Abner and all these other fools. What does he remind you of besides himself? I look at David, and every week when I look at David, as we go through this book, I'm going to be seeing Jesus again and again and again. This is Jesus all over, isn't it? Do you know the stories of Jesus? You know that he went to one town where he preached his message and they didn't receive his message. They were
aggressive. They resisted him. They were rude to him. And two of his disciples, James and John, come over with an interesting suggestion about concluding their stretch of ministry in that place. They basically say, Master, should we bring fire down from heaven to destroy this village? It's like it's just a perfunctory kind of, you know, Master, what's next? Lunch? Breakfast? Where are we going now? We've got a conference? What's the plan? Press release? Fire from heaven? That's how you get things done, isn't it? And Jesus has to kind of keep correcting it. It happens again and again. When Jesus gets arrested, his friend Peter turns up with a sword, slices someone's ear off. How dare you? Don't you dare attack my master. Takes his ear out. Jesus has to rebuke Peter. You know what Jesus says to him? He takes the guy, you know, I love Jesus, I love this. So where's his ear gone? Just kind of, what are you doing, Peter? You silly boy. Where's his, oh, there it is. Just kind of back on his, you know, kind of glue it on again. There you go. Everything's all right. It's kind of, he's just kind of looking after everybody. It's just amazing. But right there in the midst of that horrible situation, this guy's screaming and yelling with his ear on the floor, blood going everywhere. It's horrible. Jesus turns to Peter and says, no. Don't you realize I could call a legion of angels now to defend me? I could. He's got that power at his disposal. If the game was protect yourself, avoid difficulty, keep out of trouble, if that was the game, if that was the whole goal of life, then that's what I would do, Jesus is saying. I could do that. I could get through all of this. He did on one occasion. You know the story when the crowds came to throw him off a cliff? It says Jesus turned and walked through the crowd. That's quite a trick. Just turns and walks. Everyone's trying to, I don't know what happens, on a force field or something. Amazing authority and power. But his use of it was for justice, for kindness, for mercy. Ultimately, friends, for his father. He comes into the world from the Father to show us how to relate to the Father. And because he knows how to relate to the Father, he knows how to relate to power, how to relate to authority. So you need to understand the Bible is a story of God offering authority to the human race. And the human race misusing it from the beginning. That's our story. It's not that authority is wrong, it's just that we've taken the wrong version of it. God says to the man and the woman in the garden, says, I give you this world, I give you this garden, subdue it, conquer it, lead it, rule it with authority on my behalf. And then the serpent comes to them and says, I can make you to be God. Both are offering authority. One is offering legitimate, righteous authority. The other is offering grab-it-now authority. And Adam chose the grab-it-now authority. Jesus, the second Adam, comes into the world with huge promises. The Father has said to him, ask me, I will give you the nations of the world as your inheritance. God has promised his Son, not just the kingdom of Israel like he promised David, but the nations of the world are going to be yours, my son. That's the promise. That's the inheritance. Someday, all this will be yours. Jesus goes through life, pain, obscurity, people ignoring him, people mistreating him, misinterpreting him, misrepresenting him. He goes into the wilderness for a time of testing in the desert, 40 days fasting, no food. The devil comes to him. He says to him, I will give you the world's power if you bow down and worship me. In other words, you won't have to go to the cross. You won't have to go through all the pain of being cast off from society, taken outside the city and whipped and beaten and nailed up to a tree. None of that will have to happen. Bow down to me, I will give all the world to you. All of the power, all that has been promised to you. Isn't the devil clever? He promises us the thing that God would give us anyway. And so you can, if you're growing up in our culture, you can be nervous of the idea of authority at all. Am I allowed to be ambitious? Am I allowed to desire authority and influence? Is it a good thing to be ambitious in my career? to want to do more? Is it a good thing that we desire that we reach more people with the gospel? Is it a good thing to desire to have that kind of power? Well, it can be. It can be. It depends who you're trusting to get you there. David has to say to these guys, you just don't get me, do you? You take a guy's head off, you kill him, and you come to me saying, we've done it for you, we sorted it out, David, we've solved your problem. David's saying, I've never needed people like you to solve my problem. I'm trusting him. I know he's good. I know he's faithful. He will get me through this. He will raise me up in due time. And you need to know, whoever you are, being ambitious to do something great for God in your family, in your marriage, in your workplace, being raised up by God to achieve something, there is no sin in that. There's no intrinsic sin in that. It's what God wants to offer you. God wants to offer you things, and what you have is an enemy who will offer you shortcuts, will offer you sinister ways through. And God will watch our hearts to see the way we trust, see the way we're confident. See if we remind him of his son who said, my food is to do the will of my father, to finish his work. If we're like his son who said, I can do nothing without my father. The son does nothing without the father. That's the way Jesus operated. He came into the world and showed you to all this foolish race of Adamites, descendants of Adam, who've got it wrong. Jesus comes as the second Adam, the perfect man, the righteous one, who knows how to handle power, and he's meek. He's amazingly tender. He's amazingly controlled. Not that he isn't strong. Not that he can't be frightening. I mean, you ask the people that watched him clear out the temple when there were tax collectors, when there were people raising money in the temple to prevent people being able to come in and worship. Stopping people being able to worship God. You can't come in here. You're not allowed in here unless you pay our tax. Jesus is furious, and Jesus makes a whip out of cords. Jesus drives them out of the temple, turns tables over, everything going crazy. Is that meekness? You bet it is. He's meek. He's passionate. He's passionate for the right things. You know, his disciples said on that day, they noticed him and they said, zeal for your house consumes me. That's a verse they quoted from the Psalms. They're saying, look at him. That's what it means when it says that. Passion, in other words, the word zeal, a Greek word, zealos. Passion for your house consumes me. I'm consumed with passion for you. And because of that, I'm not really all that interested in my career prospect in that selfish sense. I'm interested in your great purpose being fulfilled. I'm ambitious. I can't stop myself. I'm so ambitious for your honor, for your name, for your glory. It comes out. I can't hold that back. That's meekness. David is furious with these men. He has them executed. It's horrible. Well, there's a statement there about the justice of God. He's meek. He uses power carefully in the interest of righteousness and justice. He won't let murderers go free. He sees to it that things are put right. Jesus will one day see to it that all things are put right. He's filled with passion to see that it's so. And to be changed so that we're more like him is to be filled with the same passion. Remember, I read from the book of James. And just as a kind of New Testament version of that issue that we noticed, James is talking to these people who are just like these fighters, these tribal warriors in David's day. And he says to them, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? Your passions are at war. What is driving you? Well, you have passions that drive you. You have things that have become the most important thing in your life. And they drive you to jealousy. They drive you to selfish ambition. They drive you to rage. They could even drive you to violence. And some in this room, you have been violent, literally, physically violent, in the interests of your selfish ambition. Others, it hasn't been your hands, it's been your lips, it's been your actions in other ways. It's been your scheming, your party spirit. James is very straight. Your passions are at war within you. How do we deal with these passions? Try and squash them down. Try and quieten them. Doesn't really work, does it? You can't change yourself like that. What you need is to have a new passion. What you need is to have your life interrupted by a new desire, a new longing for God and for His purpose, so that passion for His house consumes you. I want to know more and more what that is, to be so passionate and zealous for His house, for His plan, for His purpose in my life and in your life, in this church and beyond. I need Him to help me with that. I haven't got the power in myself to do that. But a huge part of it is in that clue where David says to these men, "The Lord has rescued me from every adversity." The Lord does it. The Lord rescues you. If you know He's rescued me so far, He's kept me safe from problems I've been in, He's brought me here, even here today on a Sunday, He's brought me through difficulties in my life, He's forgiven me for my sin, He's cleansed me from the past, He's called me His child. To know more and more, like David knew in his soul, the Lord is so good to me. To be dwelling on that, dwelling on in thankfulness, on His kindness and grace. Not actually dwelling on our failures, but dwelling on His grace and His mercy. To be so overwhelmed in the way that this man was is to be set free from other passions. People who are full of gratitude are not jealous. Do you hear that? People who are overwhelmed with God's mercy are not selfishly ambitious. They're just not. They're free from it. They're free from it. They're full of passion, full of ambition, but it's at God's disposal.